Yes, I sent him an email about it. Yeah.
Yeah, I thought, Joe, did you see that? Joe?
I'm sorry?
Joe, did you see Joseph Huber's 7 or 10 page paper on MMT he delivered at in Madrid at the IMMR conference?
Actually, no, I have it, but I haven't actually opened it and read it yet, no.
Well, it'll be delightful. When you need to put yourself in a good mood, you know, and you're getting ready for the big push or something like that, you got to do something. And
yeah, okay. Okay, well, I'm sure he's going to be, you know, right and right on both, so I'm sure of it.
Well, the one thing I wrote him about was the Green New Deal, because he mentions that. And I think there's a connection between Mosler and the Green New Deal, or MMT and the Green New Deal. So Paul today had this video, this YouTube, he said to watch with Grumbine. He was the leader of the whatever. And he was interviewing, I forgot that guy's name, Matthew something, who said he was, huh? Horstetter or something. Yeah. Well, this guy is saying, I was fresh out of PhD, with a brand new PhD, and Mosler approaches me. I'm thinking, isn't that interesting? But Hofstadter, and I didn't listen to the whole YouTube because I'm listening to it, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, Paul, you listened to the whole thing? But I looked up Hofstadter. He started this, what's it called? It's got the same verbiage as the Green New Deal.
Center for Full Employment and Price Stability.
It's the sustainability. Something. It's got sustainability.
Okay, the other sustainability lab. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's right. You go to the about. So I posted in this sentence from their about page, which is, you know, it's the same verbiage that you hear in the Global Green New Deal at Agenda, you know, this at the UN, blah, blah. So I think they're connected. That's my opinion. It is, that's my opinion, because their whole theory is a theory, and it's full of, you know, whatever. Poppycock.
Stephen Stare.
Oh, Stephen, we decided we're not doing stack unless we can find somebody that knows how to manage the stack.
We all know how to manage the stack.
Okay, well, we have three wonderful Norm people here, Wendell Lee and Randy, and there's us three, and it's 17 minutes after the start, so maybe we should get started.
Yep.
Okay, all right. I don't think, Lee, are you part of Norm?
No, not directly.
Not directly. Lee came from a farming family, and he is super into acres and soil rehabilitation and all that stuff. He gives us lessons when we meet sometimes at our Elgin group. Okay, so I guess we'll get started. What we've been talking about over the last few calls is this prosperity is within our grasp. So I've got what I'm calling the second chapter, and Sue's going to have the third chapter. And what we already went over in the economic riddle was basically that there's a whole bunch of stuff that we think is true that's not, and it's being obscured by theory and political philosophy and all of that. And so we need to find a way to get past that. One of the big problem with this economic riddle nobody seems to be able to solve is that there's a third of the pop. This is in 1940 or 41 when this document was written, but there's a third of the population that can't have to do without necessities of life. And why? Because that's a whole big potential market. And so Wilkins goes on to say there's enough money in circulation, and it's the credit that counts, the credit reservoir that counts. And so we had some questions when we went over this part on credit. So I want to get back to that credit in a few minutes, hopefully work on that idea. But Wilkins said what we've been doing really is having the federal government borrow and spend, and there's a better way that this team of experts found through 2 years of research, and that's the relationship between national income and farm income. And that farm income, out of any of the groups, the income sectors, gross farm income, I got to remember to say that, gross farm income has a multiple higher than, say, the labor sector. Labor is 1 to 5, so for every $1 of labor income gross, you get $5 in national income. With farming, at that point, it was $1 gross farm income, you get $7 gross national income. So farming prosperity for the nation starts, begins on the farm, basically. And so you're saying there's facts that we know about, and one of them is farmers are underpaid by, I think, at 75% of parity. And that means we're cheating ourselves out of income because of that. And that there's
It's 75% parity in 1928, right? Now it's much lower.
Way. It was 19. I'm just basing all the dates on 1940. I'm saying the booklet was written in 1940. So that's what I'm saying. You know, I don't know if it's, because that's what he says. So the income at that point was 75% of farm income, gross farm income. And then he says we have three steps to prosperity: parity prices, parity tariffs, and new industries. So I'm doing parity prices. Sue will do parity tariffs, and then we haven't figured out who's going to do new industries. So we'll have to do that, maybe when Sue does hers. So, and my segment starts on page 8, and hopefully you can have your documents open to that, because I'm going to be going back and forth between those two pages mostly. I'm going to spend most of my time on the first segment of my chapter. And it's divided into three segments. Parity prices means 100 cent dollar. That's the first segment. Second segment, parity price, not price fixing. Third segment, why the nation is in the red. Okay. So if we can just look real quickly at page 9, what the Senate Committee on Agriculture and Forestry said. And on that page, they've got a list there, what I'm going to call the historical record. Okay? In 1800, the dollar was valued in commodities at 100. That's what I'm calling the historical record. Okay. And they also say in their introductory words, they say, they say in black and blue white what the problem is. The farm problem is a price problem. Then they give the definition of parity, basically, what the farmer receives for his products and what he has to pay for the things he has to buy. And then the last kicker is the farm dollar fluctuates the most widely, and it has the most unstable dollar of any group that any group has to contend with. So they're laying it out there for us. I don't know what happened, but they laid it out right there. Now, this historical record corresponds to the exhibit on the previous page, or the chart, whatever we want to call it. And in the first paragraph, Wilkins says that this chart, this exhibit, reveals that we have not had parity exchange value for goods and commodities except during limited and widely separated periods. And he said that's why that chart explains how and why so much of the wealth has been created in America, and it's been siphoned off from the hands of producers of raw materials to the hands of others, okay? And so we can look at the chart, and it gives a really good visual picture of what's going on. The title of the chart is The Value of the Dollar Controls Prices, and Prices Control Income and Prosperity. And the top line, that jagged line all the way across up until 1914, is dollar value mostly, and I'm going to get to that in a second. And the bottom line is commodity value. When we look at our record on the next page, we see there's two times the United States has had a 100 cent dollar, in 1800 and again in 1926. So you look at the chart and you see that in 1800, right up until the War of 1812 about, the dollar value and the commodity value are either meeting or they're traveling in what I think Wilkin would call parity, between about 89 cents for the commodity value and $1.12, somewhere around there for the dollar value. 1926 does about the same thing. That even comes a little bit closer. And I think I'm going to talk about this later, but the 1920s were no walk in the park for farmers, so this isn't like a free lunch. Anyhow, in 1812, we had the War of 1812, and when you look at the historical record, you see that the dollar was valued in commodities at 155 cents. So that line inverted right there. You've got the dollar value down at the bottom, 65 cents, and commodity value, dollar is valued in commodities at $1.55. The same thing happened in the Civil War and again in the War of World War I. I just thought that was kind of interesting there. The other thing is, the Great Depression, it didn't invert, nor did it during the populist. I don't know what happened during the war, the U.S.-Mexican War, because it looks like there's no inversion. Maybe that's because the war was too short. I don't know. That was 1845 to 47, I think. And there's no meeting of those lines at that point. Anyhow, what I want to do is kind of go over some definitions that we've discussed in previous calls, and then take a look at what I'm going to call 19th century thought leaders had to say. And so what I'm trying to paint a better picture of are terms or words like money, credit, parity, 100-cent dollar, capital, wealth, primary bartering power or primary income, the difference between bargaining and barter, especially in terms of how price is established. I hope this isn't going to be horribly boring. It was really interesting to me. So the first word from a previous call is wealth. And Randy gave a kind of a Saadi-esque definition. He said, wealth is a flow of energy that supports human life. And because wealth obeys the laws of physics, it will rust, it'll rot, decay, and so it has to be continually replaced. Now, I want to contrast that a little bit with Henry George, whom I didn't include in the 19th century thought leaders for a few reasons, not important, but mostly here because we can contrast what he was saying about this definition and another one. And he said, wealth is all material things produced by labor for the satisfaction of human desire. But he excluded human qualities, like skill and mental acumen, because they're not material and hence not wealth. Now, that definition, that second part, is going to vary from what these 19th century thought leaders said about wealth, and I think what Norm is saying about wealth. They would not agree with that. Am I right, guys?
Oh, I don't know.
Would you say that human qualities like mental and physical exertion are not wealth?
Well, they're only wealth when you put them to work, when you bring, it's only wealth when it either helps you or someone else.
Right. I'm not an expert in Georgia.
So we have to be able to apply what's in our heads fingers and the stuff around us.
Exactly.
We have to demonstrate our mastery of these things, this physical existence.
Right. And that's so George is going to be separating ways from the 19th century thought leaders, for sure. But he put physical or mental exertion in with labor, so he had a different way of looking at it. Okay, so next word, capital. Randy said, capital is a buildup of energy that can be used to increase, and I think this definition is really important for us to try to get a hold of. But capital is a buildup of energy that can be used, it's so different from how we usually think of capital. So capital is a buildup of energy that can be used to increase your productive capabilities. Capital is not money, but it can be counted in terms of money. Capital is a tool to increase our ability to make more things, make things better, produce better housing, better clothing, and so forth. So capital is wealth because it's used to produce either more wealth or more capital. And Henry George said that capital is wealth used in the process of production, and only two primary factors, labor and land, are absolutely necessary to create wealth. So not much difference there. And the Georges also say that their most important objective in political economy is to understand the distribution of wealth in society. Okay, so I would say that's exactly what Wilkin and his team were trying to get across in this booklet. But that brings me back to Wilkin, because he's got a couple of definitions I wanted to rehash. One, the first one, the first two, he's talking about income, and he describes two types of income. One is primary bartering power that he also called primary income, and I'm going to bring this up in a few minutes, but again, a question. But he said this kind of income is created by the production and sale of the materials of new wealth, and it's made up of two things, number of units produced and price received per unit. Okay? That's primary bartering power or primary income. And then the other type of income that Wilkins described was earned income that's derived from wages, interest, and profits. Okay, so interest you would get from savings or investments, profits from a business that you had or whatever. And then parity is the last thing. And he said parity, this is his words, means giving value to money in the form of goods and commodities, not in giving value to these essential things in terms of money. And I think that's going to take us a little bit deeper into the concept of money in a few minutes. But it also is, I think, something, I'm pretty sure it's something that Randy was trying to get us, AMIers, to wrap our brains around last fall. But let me continue, because I wanted to bring in a contemporary thinker on money. In that discussion board, we were talking about the Chicago Plan Revisited presentation that was on YouTube with Michael Kumhoff. And I don't know how you guys got to watch it so quickly. It took me like 3 weeks to watch it. But anyway, Michael Kumhoff defined money as equity of the Commonwealth. Okay? And that kind of goes along with my perspective that the act of sovereign money creation is to provide a public credit. And so that's, I've got that definition on the doodle page underneath the 100-cent dollar. And it's basically combines Joseph Huber, okay, with this public credit idea. Public credit is a sovereign money placed in the public's account for completion of a duly authorized and achievable public project based on the promise of the people to be productive and a promise to keep control of the quantity of money. And that last sentence is Huber's directly. Okay, so a detour back to the 19th century and some of the terms we're going to run into. Labor versus capital, exchange of days labor for days labor, two types of wealth, definition of money in the context of function and purpose, price and price relationships, and so on. So what I want to start with, in our book, Prosperity is Within Our Grasp, on the original title page, there was a quote, two quotes. One was from Abraham Lincoln, and the way it reads is, labor is prior to and creates all capital. That is from, it's kind of a paraphrasing of Lincoln's December 3rd, 1861 annual message to Congress. And Randy gave it one at the, I listened to your talks, guys. You did really good. And Randy, I don't know why you complained about yourself. But anyway, Lincoln in this segment is addressing what he calls the labored arguments that were then being used to promote replacement of popular government with what he called returning despotism. Okay? And he says, in my present position, I would scarcely be justified were I to admit raising a warning voice against this approach of returning despotism. And I'm thinking about what's happening today. That's me, personally. So he goes on and he says, after a bit, he says, this, what he's referring to as this returning despotism is the effort to place capital on an equal footing with, if not above, labor in the structure of government. And then he equates this whole effort with the desire for slavery and, you know, keep people in their place where they're born with. But he's, and then he goes on. There is no such relationship between capital and labor as assumed, nor is there any such thing as a free man being fixed for life in the condition of a hired laborer. Both these assumptions are false, and all inferences from them are groundless. Labor is prior to and independent of capital. Capital is only the fruit of labor and could never have existed if labor had not first existed. Labor is superior of capital and deserves much the higher consideration. Now, I'm sharing this with you because it's going to come up again. This concept is going to come up again in a few minutes. But Lincoln had an economic advisor. His chief economic advisor was a guy by the name of Henry Carey, who's been called the founder of the American economic system. Carey was a big proponent of government-issued money in the greenback. He was also a vocal, outspoken opponent of so-called free international trade. He wrote a lot about both, talked to Congress, and on. But he wrote a book in 1851 that's online, digitized, called Harmony of Interests. And it is about trade, what he's, that book. But in the little short excerpt I'm going to share, he's in effect referring to the concept of fair exchange. And he says, and also returning despotism, by the way, he says, two systems are before the world. One looks to giving the products of millions of acres of land and of labor of millions of men for the services of hundreds of thousands of distant men. The other system before the world looks to bringing the distant men to consume on the land the products of the land, exchanging day's labor for day's labor. Now, as just as an aside, in 1865, Carey published another book called The Way to Outdo England Without Fighting Her, and that the key to that book, the thesis was that we should issue our own money. But and that's online, too. You can find that online. So now, getting back to our exhibit on page 8, there's a big bubble that forms after the Civil War, started forming after the Civil War. You get the dollar value moving way up into the stratosphere and commodity values going way down. And the peak period here is 1896, when supposed silverite William Jennings Bryan and the newly anointed goldbugger William McKinley duked it out for the presidency. That was the height of the populist era. The dollar value was way up at $2.35, commodity value way down in the toilet at 46 cents. So there's four big reasons for that bubble, and you guys probably know them all. But I just want to go through them real quick. The first reason was that the U.S. had made a political decision, mainly using the tariff as a football, political football, but they made a political decision to go from fourth to first place. Hi, Sue. We're in the middle of we've already started.
Okay.
So open up your booklet. We're on the exhibit, the chart, the exhibit chart.
Okay.
Whatever you want to call it, page 8.
And Randy's recording, so thank God.
Well, I've got this. I can make it into notes so it's not so scattered about, because I have to go back and forth different places. But I can also put it into notes. What was I? Okay, so where we're at is 1896, the populist period where the dollar value reaches an all-time high in our history up to 1940 at $2.35 and commodity values an all-time low at 46 cents, okay? And this is the biggest bubble we've had in our history. It kind of shrank after the War of 1812 to the Civil War, and then after the Civil War, it really exploded. And four reasons for that. One, we made a political decision to go from fourth to first place as the world's leading industrial power. We did it in 30 years, 1866 to 1896. Second thing was the Homestead Act. There was two of them, actually. 1862 opened up the western public domain areas, and then 1866 opened up the five public domain states in the south. It was both acts were intended to get small farmers established on a place that they could earn an income. But unfortunately, they were undermined by what the populists called the money power. And the land became, a lot of it became, this is one of the key objections of the populists, they were opened to the land barons. So you had a lot of the cattle barons running the roughshod over the southwest. You had the bonanza farms in the northern plains. And, of course, you had the plantation oligarchs still in the south. Then the other thing is, nothing happened, though, with these acts because you had the Civil War right away. But the other thing right in 1866 was all of these a whole series of legislative acts that served to dramatically reduce the money supply. They were deliberately calculated to do that, and that was one of the big populist complaints, was that they needed more money in circulation. And 1866, they started taking the greenbacks out of circulation. 1869, they had the Credit Strengthening Act that made debts payable in gold or silver, then lawful money. 1873, they had the demonetization of silver because it was getting too cheap to produce, and so they put America was put on a de facto gold standard. Cut really the money supply in half again with that Act of 73 through the whole country into depression. And then the fourth thing, production increased dramatically during those three decades. And I'm going to give you two examples. They're eye-popping to me. The Great Dakota Boom took place roughly between the mid-1870s and 1889, and it's one of the big startling examples of how production increased. 7 years, from 1880 to 1887, wheat production alone went from 3 million bushels to 60 million bushels of wheat in 7 years in Dakota Territory. And just by way of comparison, it took Illinois and Indiana 50 years together to get that 60 million bushels of wheat per year. Then this other guy who was writing treatises for the populists and the farmers' alliances, he was a Kansas lawyer, S.S. King. In this one, I think it's called Of Seeds and Harvest, I forget, but it was published in 1892. And he's writing about the 21 producing states, which exclude, because he's using the census reports from 1880 to 1890, that excludes the South and North Dakota, because they'd only become states in mid to late 1889. So he says that these 21 producing states, Indiana, Illinois, Iowa, and so on and so forth, they were a wonderland of diversified resources with six times as much land and twice as many people to cultivate it. But they were able to accumulate only one half as much wealth in the period named 1880 to 1890. Nine manufacturing, bondholding, banking, money lending, and railroad-owning states of Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island, New York, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey. He then says, The internal commerce of these 21 producing states was already greater than all the foreign commerce of the combined nations of the world, which is pretty amazing. And yet they were only able to accumulate half as much wealth. I found some more stuff by another fellow I'm going to share with you. But what he said, and he's giving the statistics, he was saying there was actually more debt. There was wealth accumulating in these nine bond-holding states, but there was more debt among the citizenry than there was even in the Dakota Territory or in the South. In the South, it was really brutal. Anyway, okay, back to the chart on page 8 of the document. Wilkin writes in the third sentence of that paragraph that he says, this is a quote, because production of new wealth has expanded constantly, primary bartering power, regardless of price per unit, has been sufficient to provide markets for our greatly expanded industrial output. I want to pull in just a little bit of Randy here, because it appears to me from that exhibit, from our graph, that a lot of the capital structure, could you say, or flow of wealth that we depend on today was built primarily by the producers and laborers from 1800 through to 1940, the Great Depression, and, you know, including the Great Depression.
Well, I don't know. Depends on what you want to look at for turnover. What really has been accumulated is a continuing development of the knowledge of how to, in other words, we don't make steel the same way today that we did 120 years ago.
Right, right.
So
yeah.
The thing that is being developed here is the human capacity to master the tools that are required to operate or to make an industrial economy function.
Right. Okay. So
as far as accumulating wealth, you know, really what they're saying here is that if, I don't care who it is, whether it's a professor trying to teach engineering or a street sweeper who's trying to get home before the supper's cold, everybody has to perform their job. And who's going to decide which job is more important than another?
Okay. So what I'm trying to do is correlate this whole graph. The first thing is that primary bartering power here in before 1940, and that this is going to be key in a minute. But that primary bartering power, he's saying, regardless of price per unit. Okay, so they're taking, they're lowering their price per unit here when they're getting the commodity level, not even the farm prices, are down at 46 cents per unit.
Yep.
So they're being forced to take, create more products.
Well,
in order
what he's
to
saying
make
is that the constant output, the shortage in the raw material income has not impacted the consumption because the money system was not focused on debt, and folks were either helping each other out or they were drawing their holdings, their own private stashes of money out of the mattresses.
Right. But this is telling us why the wealth is being siphoned from the hands of the producers. This chart is you can look at it. It's a visual picture of how this.
Right.
Sherry, just repeat the page number where the chart is.
It's actually page 12 in the PDF.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it's right. The first page of the parity prices. We're going to spend most of the time on these two pages. So anyhow, what I want to do next is kind of delve into the writings of what I'm going to call two more. So Lincoln was a 19th century thought leader, Henry Carey was, and I want to look into two more thought leaders that you probably never heard of.
Well, can I add a comment here?
Sure.
Just so you'll know, Henry Carey was actually a free trader until he decided that the impact on the economy, until he did the research and calculated the numbers.
Uh-huh.
Then he decided that that was actually not in the national interest to have free trade.
Interesting. Interesting.
So a guy who changed his opinion.
Yeah. And he, but that was in the harmony of interest. I read that a long time ago, I have to say, really long time ago. But in that harmony of interest, he was not, that was not, he was not advocating free trade in that one.
Certainly not. That's correct.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
Jerry, is Carey, C-A-R-E-Y?
Yep.
Yes. Yeah.
Thanks. And it's Henry C. Carey. There's two father and son, Henry A. Carey and Henry C. Carey.
Okay, so what I'm going to look at is two more 19th century thought leaders. And the first one is a South Dakotan by the name of Henry Lukes. And this guy was actually, he was the leader of, I'm going to say, the Dakota Alliances, which was part of the Northern Farmers Alliance. At the same, he became elected president in 1886. At the same time McCune was coming up, he merged the agricultural wheel with his Southern Alliance. And those two organizations were like night and day. They were totally different from each other. The Northern Alliances accepted, you know, anyone into their alliance, you know, black, female, Catholic, you know, whatever. If you were on a farm, you're part of the alliance. They also wanted to form alliances with labor, like the Terrence Powderly's organization. He had the Greenback and Knights of Labor, okay. McCune excluded that. One of the things they did was exclude blacks specifically, even though when he merged with the agricultural wheel, there were blacks in there. So the Northern Alliance was trying to hammer out a way to join together with the Northern and Southern Alliance. They held several conventions. They finally figured out a way, and Lukes, along with some of the other leaders in the Northern Alliance, figured that they had gotten a good enough agreement, but they couldn't agree on the secrecy issue, and a lot of the Northern Alliance left. But Kansas and Henry Lukes and some of the South Dakota people stayed in. Henry Lukes becomes president of the National Farmers Alliance. Polk is named president first, and Lukes vice president. Polk dies suddenly. Lukes becomes president. Then there's a big dust-up with Charles McCune. He gets he leaves in a cloud, under a dark cloud, let's say that. And Lukes... they both recuse themselves from of the next election, and Lukes wins anyway. And so he's president of the National Farmers Alliance, and he's asked to write a textbook. And he finishes it in 1883. It's called The New Monetary System. I have not been able to find it anywhere, but you can find the revised edition published in 1895 at archive.org. It's hard to read, but you can find it. Anyway, he says, I'm just going to pick some phrases and themes from a couple of the chapters. So in chapter 3, he's talking about supply and demand. And obviously, the populace were told all the time that they were overproducing, and that's why their prices were so low. And the same thing was going on. The farmers are always told all these goofy things. But anyway, one of the populace favorite retorts was that the makers of clothes are underfed, and the makers of food are underclad. And Lukes himself, in his textbook, says that America was really suffering from an underconsumption problem, not an overproduction problem. And Mary Elizabeth Lease, one of the paid lecturers, also a lawyer, Kansan, she, in one of her most popular speeches, she would say that statistics tell us that 10,000 little children starve to death in the U.S. every year, and shop girls have to sell their, in New York, have to sell their virtue for a slice of bread. But anyway, overproduction, obviously, they weren't buying that whole thing. And so Luke's writes in his concluding sentences, "We have shown that supply and demand as applied to products is not the sole cause of low or high prices, that the ability to buy is necessary to create a demand, and that to give ability to purchase, labor must receive a high price for its labor, and the medium of exchange be sufficient to comply with demand. When prices are high, there's an increasing demand, and vice versa." Okay, then he gets into the responsibility of government in terms of money in the next chapter, and he says, "Neither gold, silver, nickel, copper, or paper is money until the fiat of government is stamped upon it. When that's done, it assumes a legal value regardless of its commodity value. The Farmers Alliance, together with 21 other farm and labor organizations, demands that the government shall make and issue the money the people need, a full legal tender for all debts, public and private." Now, during the Civil War, they were issuing all different kinds of money, and they have treatises on those, you know, demand notes and the national bank notes. But anyway, he says, "The government should issue this money in sufficient volume to do the business of the country on a cash basis. That is, exchange the products of labor on a cash basis." Then he continues, "All charges for the use of money to exchange the products of labor is a tax on and paid by labor. A limited supply enables the user who owns the money to exact such rates for its use as to rob labor of its just reward. To be free, labor must be emancipated from the power of money to oppress." Okay, we're going to be getting in a few minutes to the parity idea. In Chapter 6, he's talking about the only scientific basis for the proper supply of money. And I didn't mention, he's got a whole lot of references through this book. He quotes Baudin and Aristotle and Tiffany on constitutional law, which was the go-to book. He quotes Supreme Court cases and all of this stuff. And he quotes, of course, the U.S. Monetary Commission, because I found one article in 1893 in a Dakota newspaper where they're talking about Alexander's Delmar's discussion on velocity of money, and they're saying how that would be applied to money in the West, which moves much slower. Anyway, in this, he's quoting here again from the U.S. Monetary Commission, and he says,
Jerry, who is this again?
This is Lukes, Henry Lukes. We're still on this South Dakota guy that's head of the Farmers Alliance.
And was it a book or something?
Yes, The New Monetary System is what we're talking about.
Thank you.
The book is called, and you can find it at archives. Maybe if I can find the link, I can send it in the notes. But anyway, the quote he takes from the U.S. Monetary Commission is, "General prosperity and a general fall of prices never did and never can coexist." So they kind of knew it then. Anyway, he writes, "Contraction of the currency," in fact, Jefferson knew it, "contraction of the currency can be accomplished in either one of two ways. First, you can increase the demand for use, and that's an effective contraction of the currency. Or second, you can decrease the supply," which is what they were going through. And the effect is going to be the same in either case. And what he's talking about, this contraction of when you get an increased demand for use, that's to him what he calls due to the inventive genius of mankind, who keeps devising all these new labor-saving appliances so that, you know, one man can do the work of many. So they had the McCormick Reaper and all this stuff that was allowing them to increase production. But, of course, those reapers cost a lot of money. Anyway, basically, when you can apply the inventive genius of man, you're going to have, because of that, you're going to get a lot more products to sell for money.
Well, there's another aspect to that, too. And
okay.
I guess is what he was talking about. The inventive genius of man was essentially on chiseling and cheating.
That's not what I got from the chapter, but maybe.
Well, it's because that's really what's going on now with the push towards cashless society today.
To
make sure that the money actually has zero velocity. that there is nothing to exchange. There is nothing to flow. It all comes and goes through a piece of plastic tethered to a bank, a debt-issuing institution, and the only velocity happens within the clearinghouse.
Okay. You're going to have to explain, talk about that a little bit more when we get to the last segment. Hopefully. So hold that thought.
Right.
And maybe he was, that's what he was referring to there, too. Maybe I'm going to have to reread that chapter.
Because bankers have always fiddled with
right, yeah.
Who they can con.
Yeah, absolutely. And he knew it, too.
Yeah.
Anyway, so what he's saying in this chapter, because he'll say that in a couple when I'm talking about something else, but in this chapter, what he's saying is that the only scientific basis for proper supply of money is demand for use, and the supply has to keep pace with the volume of products to be exchanged. And then the next chapter, 8, has to do with fair exchange. The idea of fair exchange. And what he's doing here is talking, when he says the opposition, he means the gold buggers, the guys that were saying we need to keep the money supply small. We don't need more money in circulation. And so here's his statement. When the opposition is forced to admit the proposition that the volume of money in circulation regulates the value of products to be exchanged, they meet us with the counterproposition that while it is true that an increase in the volume of money would increase the price of what we have to sell, it would at the same time increase the price of what we have to buy, which in the end would be of no benefit to us, but would upset our present financial system, which they claim is the very best in the world, in proof of which they assert, and it is true, that a dollar now will buy more of the necessities and luxuries than at any other time during the last 30 years. They seemingly forget that there are two sides to the question. It will require more of the products of labor to buy that dollar now, and we are on the other side. So there he's saying, and when you look at the exhibit, you see, yes, it's going to take a whole lot more product to get, you know, get $2, that dollar that's actually worth $2.35. Okay, chapter 9, he's talking about price stability. And on the exhibit, you know, on that chart, it's showing you that the dollar has no stability at all, and commodity values are mostly, you know, in a downward trend. Anyway, he writes, stability of prices can only be maintained when money and products to be exchanged increase in equal relative proportion. A money that appreciates in value is just as dishonest as a money that depreciates in value, and more injurious in that it benefits the few, the creditors, and injures the many, the debtors. Money of changing value is and has been in all ages the harvest of money changers and speculators. It's impossible to have a stable money responding to the demands of trade as needed based on anything uncertain in quantity and depending wholly upon chance for or accident for discovery. The first essential for an honest dollar is stability. Any change in the volume of currency as compared with demand for its use causes instability and benefits one class of the community at the expense of the another. The moneyed class understands this proposition thoroughly. Being creditors and shrewd, they combine to protect their interests, which is that they may be paid in the dearest dollar, and that's why England persists in the gold standard. She's the great creditor nation. We became the great creditor nation during World War I. Okay, so now I want to get on to the next fellow, the second fellow, thought leader, and his name was Nelson A. Dunning. It's really hard to find information on him that's solid information. I found some that indicates that he was an editor for McCune's, the National Economist, Charles McCune's National Economist, which was the media organ for the Southern Alliances.
Say his name again, please.
Nelson A. Dunning, D-U-N-N-I-N-G.
Okay.
Okay, and he wrote a book that Luke uses for his book, by the way, sections of it. But he wrote a book in 1887 called Philosophy of Price and Its Relationship to Domestic Currency. And it's online. And now there's two groups that I know of that are digitizing, putting into paperback form some of these. They're recovering these old books. And this one, I think, has been digitized by a group called Forgotten Books. And there's another group called Scholar Select that are recovering some of these old books and trying that. Because Henry Luce is hidden by a wall of academia. It's really hard. And Nelson A. Dunning, I don't know where you can find him. But anyhow, the terms he's going to be getting into, wealth, money, price, and price relationships, role of bargaining and barter within that context, the law of supply and demand as it relates to overproduction, and the manner in which products are distributed. Okay, the first up is wealth, and he says, wealth is divided into two classes, visible and invisible, and this is, to me, Saadi-esque. He says, visible wealth includes money, houses, merchandise, the desk and the chair we were talking about previously, and things like that. Invisible wealth consists of physical or mental exertion stored up in the human body by nature as a means of self-preservation. The latter is the creator of the first, as all visible wealth, including money, is the production of the invisible. So that's in keeping, Randy, right, with what you were talking about, with, like I said, now this invisible wealth, it's accumulated knowledge over the last 200 years, actually, you know,
right.
since civilization was born. Okay, so I just thought that was really interesting. Now, the next concept is money. Okay, and we're going to spend a few minutes on this. And it's going to harken back to, I think, what Randy was trying to get us to wrap our brains around back last fall. Okay? So he writes, this is what Nelson A. Dunning writes. And this is just excerpts taken from throughout his book. So, it's not, you're not going to read it in one fell swoop. But anyway, he says, there is a common misconception of error of the commercial world, which error seems to have made way for many others. Duh. Money does not buy products. Products always buy or purchase money. That's really hard, and I don't know how many people today can really... I mean, I was having a really tough time figuring that out last fall. But anyway, let me say it again. Money does not buy products. Products always buy or purchase money. And he goes through a bunch of examples, and I'm going to share just a few of them. And the first one is this wagon maker who's built a wagon so that he can buy some money from the farmer. All right. Now, the farmer has already raised surplus wheat, so he could buy money that he wants to use to purchase, quote-unquote, the wagon. And so they go to market, and there's a bargaining process that takes place. And the wagon maker who's willing to sell the farmer his wagon at the cheapest price is going to be able to purchase that farmer's money. All right. So Dunning's telling us, remember, a bargain is nothing more than an agreement between two or more parties, and it has nothing to do with barter. So I'm trying to work this into Wilkins' primary bartering power. Anyway, Dunning also says, talks about the farmer might have to use some of his money to pay his debts. And if he does that, what he's actually doing is making a delivery of what he had already sold and agreed to deliver sometime previously. And by the same token, the wagon maker might need to use some of the money he got from the farmer to pay his workmen who'd already purchased that money with their labor to build the wagon. And a little bit later, Dunning asserts that money can only be utilized by the laborer in his vocation as a medium to obtain some product of labor that he wants to use. And by way of illustration, Dunning asks, can a man cut down a tree with a $5 bill? No, he will first sell enough of his money to obtain an axe, and with that product of labor, he will cut down the tree. So basically, Dunning is using those kinds of examples to show that money, it's not money that does the purchasing. It's labor, and it's the products of labor that are actually sold in order to purchase money. And then Dunning also reminds us that there's always an obligation that precedes the payment of money. That obligation is either labor or its products or the stipulated payment of money, and in the case of debt, or paying your workman, of one or both. Okay, so he's making a case, essentially, that in its legitimate use, money has no purchasing power. And how can this be? Well, he says it's for the express reason that money is a creation of law. What we might say, the AMIers, money is an abstract social power embodied in law as an unconditional means of payment or something thereof, or just the creation of law. But this is what Dunning says. Money has no purchasing power because it's a creation of law. And Dunning says that money actually, in its true sense, is not a product of labor in its truest sense. Money never goes in advance. Labor takes the lead and money follows. Money is the incentive for production. That's why we produce. Or it greases, like Zarlenga would say, it greases the wheels of commerce. So if you destroy the fact that production buys money, it will, to a large extent, mean that all surplus extra production will cease. So in another area, Dunning is again emphasizing money has no purchasing power, and this is due to the fact that it has one function, which is to pay debts or settle up the difference in bargains.
Well, I'd modify that a bit. It has no, really what he's trying to point out is, other than trying to disrupt people's standard beliefs, is that he's trying to point out that the process should be one where the production of the commodities puts the value in the money, not the creation of the money itself.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Exactly. But he's also getting, the other part he's getting to, I think, is the difference, all of this put together, is the difference between the bargaining process and the bartering, because then he gets into the idea that money can't be bartered for money. So, yes, it's the value, putting the value into the money through
that ain't
the...
true no more.
Well, we're talking about 19th century thought leaders here.
I know.
So we can hopefully bring it up to date in the last segment Why the Nation is in Debt. Hopefully.
Yep.
Anyway, he's talking about money can't be bartered for money because it only has that one function, to settle up the difference in bargains. But products could be and often are bartered for each other. They still are. And in that case, both parties to the transaction are benefited. In the bartering process, we see products exercising purchasing function independent and exclusive of money, but on the other hand, money can't perform its functions without the aid of products. So, summing it up, Dunning is saying that's why capital can't employ labor. Labor employs capital always, but doesn't employ labor. It only employs some previous product of labor. And so that's why I think that's harkening back to me what Lincoln is saying, that labor is the superior of capital.
Right.
So then he gets into price and price relationships, and this is going to take another few minutes. He's talking about the value of money is correctly indicated by the general range of prices. And he says, we notice that the price of one article, labor, and he's including the farmer in here, we notice that the price of one article, labor, governs all other prices in the normal conditions of trade that the products of that labor come into direct contact with. The price of labor determines the price of Farmer B's wheat, and the price of his wheat determines the price of all his purchases. So we're starting to get this parity relationship idea. He also says the necessity of having a fair price and to begin in the right place is not only just, but important to the general welfare of mankind, and that place is with labor. When labor brings a good price, everything else does, vice versa. And a little bit later on, he's saying, what is known as the conflict between capital and labor is not so much a conflict between other forms of capital and labor as it is between money and labor. And then he says that the conflict between money and other forms of capital can be as bad as the conflict between money and labor because other forms of capital are going to suffer just as much as labor, but that other those other forms of capital can be sold for money. So they're able to endure losses a little bit later, better than labor. And he points out that money, in either shrinking or unduly increasing in volume, separates capitalists from labor. And then he makes the statement that really the anger of society should be directed not against capital, but against the false financial system that permits the volume of money to either shrink or unduly increase. And then he goes into the idea, the problem for labor is that unlike money, labor can't be hoarded. Day's labor unperformed is so much capital lost forever to the laborer and to society. And this, I think, is getting kind of close to that other method of looking at credit that we were talking about when you said, Randy, that Wilkin had a slightly different idea of credit than what we might think of. And I think the part of that credit was the reservoir of credit was this untapped labor. That's what I got from this anyway. To continue, Dunning is saying that labor being the worker's only capital and his only means of existence, he can't wait on better times for better wages, and because absolute necessity is going to force him to dispose of his labor on any terms which the owners of money indicate. So in our chart, you're seeing that labor is indeed, labor including the farmer, being forced to dispose of his labor at rock bottom prices. And that's making, you know, the money power wealthier. Okay, so he says, get rid of this false financial system and let labor and capital be put on equal terms so that idle capital will be as unfruitful as idle labor, and the conflict between them will cease to be productive. Now, one of the things I thought about here was Dunning is not saying, as I think Michael Hudson does, that price, and I'm assuming also monetary value, involves the establishment of price relationships between commodities. This much gold equals that much silver equals that much wheat. What Dunning is saying is that the general range of prices give value to money, and it's similar to how Wilkin is defining parity. The price of one article, labor, Wilkin would say, especially farm labor or farmers, will govern all other prices in the normal conditions of trade. Then he talks about price being commercial value, and commercial value is established by the ability of people to purchase. Further, he says the ability to purchase is greater or less as the volume of currency is increased or decreased. However, price relationships between all other things besides money are not affected by the volume of money or by its increase or decrease. So when we were reading Wilkins talking about there's enough money in circulation, and we have it's credit that counts. I think that has application here. Price relationships between all other things besides money are not affected by the volume of money or by its increase or decrease.
What he's saying.
But anyway, let me go on and make it, maybe this will become clearer in the next couple of sentences.
Well, what he's saying is the same thing Wilkins said about you can have prosperity at any price level.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's it. Okay, good, you've got it. So anyway, a couple more things. He's saying exchange by barter. Unlike bargaining, can be as equitably affected under one volume of money and under one range of prices as another. But under a credit system, where contracts aggregating, aggregating a vast amount of money, a vast amount to pay money at future periods have been made, steadiness in price becomes the all-important consideration. And that steadiness depends on the steadiness in the quantitative relation between money and all other things. The command, therefore, which commodities and services may have over money in the future, and which will find its expression in price, becomes a matter of vital importance. Now, as just an aside about this word barter, Michael Kumhoff said in that presentation, Chicago Plan Revisited, that economists who work in banking today erroneously conceptualize the activities of banking as being based on loanable funds theory or barter. I thought that was kind of interesting. I mean, I perked up when I heard him say that. It's like, what? Barter? What are you talking about? It took me a while to figure out how he was figuring that, making that equation. Anyway, the one last segment that Dunning has is the law of supply and demand, and, of course, the corollary or overproduction. Now, that part might be kind of interesting to read because I thought it was pretty funny. It's dripping in sarcasm. I'm just going to give you a few little snippets. But he says, the law of supply and demand is a dangerous doctrine, and from it emanates many destructive theories. Here is an argument where too great a victory brings defeat, too much happiness brings distress and misery. Let us examine the subject in that light. Does an overproduction of wheat and beef cause my neighbor to go hungry, and an abundant supply of clothing the cause of it being ragged, and on and on? Certainly not. In all these cases, the supply is abundant, the demand most urgent. Yet the supply is not lessened, nor the demand satisfied. Why? Because there's a want of ability to purchase. It's plain there can be no real overproduction unless a large surplus remains after all the people have been fully supplied with the necessaries and comforts of life. The public, this is the same thing the norm people say, the public cannot overtrade by distributing each year's production among those who really need to use them. We must look, therefore, for the real cause of these calamities, not in overproduction, but in the power that governs the distribution of the products. It doesn't matter how urgent the demand or abundance of supply. That sounds like Wilkin right there. It doesn't matter how urgent It doesn't matter how urgent the demand or abundance of supply. There must be some ability to purchase or the demand is not satisfied. How, then, can it be truthfully said that supply and demand are the sole arbiters of price? There can be no price without a purchaser, no purchaser without the necessary ability to purchase. Therefore, it must follow that the ability to purchase in all cases absolutely establishes commercial value. And he goes on to say there might be isolated instances that prove the exception to the rule, but those are self-correcting, just like Randy has told us before. And he says, let me illustrate this point, that supply and demand do not make the price. Mr. A has a good dinner to sell. Mr. B is hungry. Mr. A has the supply, and Mr. B has demand. In this case, what establishes the price of the dinner? Its original cost to Mr. A or Mr. B's hungry stomach? Neither. The commercial value is finally and fully fixed by the context of Mr. B's pocketbook. It should always be remembered that price knows no original cost, no matter how much a bushel of wheat costs in production. Its commercial value is made without regard to it. The idea that cost of production enters into price is all wrong. Price is what it will sell for and nothing else. Hence, I would say, the need for parity. And this idea is reinforced by another example from Henry Lukes I want to share with you, and then we're done with this part. But in this, he published a little book in 1919 called that's been resurrected by Scholar Select. And the book was called Our Daily Bread Must Be Freed from the Greed of Monopoly, so you get an idea of what it was about. But in the segment I'm going to share, he's talking about how the tariff has long been used as a political football, and that basically always ended up with the cost of living continuing to go up. And this is what he said. Labor organized and struck for higher wages, and just as they succeeded, the cost of production increased, and the cost of living went higher, an endless chain with each change growing worse. The iron law of wage was asserting itself. It was not the number of dollars a month that you received that controlled, but the amount of things you needed to exchange for the dollar. Sounds a little like parity to me. Anyway, and I don't think, obviously he didn't know about the math that was going into the parity concept developed by Wilkin and his team. Anyway, he continues a little bit. I thought it was kind of funny. He talks about the tariff again being revised under President Taft, and he says Taft needed to also appease the industrial East. So what they did was practically duplicate the policy of trying to reduce the cost of living, again, once again, at the expense of agriculture, by placing raw materials products on the quote-unquote free list and protecting manufactured products. That's what they were doing in the populist era a lot of times, especially toward the end, toward the last 20 years or so. Then later, after quoting an article that appeared in this newspaper in Dakota called the Argus Leader, the July 1st, 1915 edition, he's quoting, this is a quote from the Argus Leader, the buying of food and food products for belligerents of Europe is centralized in the hands of a bunch of Wall Street financiers. The latter have the art of deceiving the American public well in hand. Then Luce goes on to say, I want to thank the Argus Leader for this polite way of referring to the pirates of Wall Street. I have shown the effects on our markets by Canada complying with the tariff conditions, a drop of 9 cents per bushel in the price of wheat. I have referred to the use of one of the minor exporting nations, Argentina. When our speculators wanted to boost the price of farm products other than wheat under the authority given the president as a war measure, the Food Administration under Herbert Hoover placed an embargo on the importation of farm products. This gave the speculators a perfect monopoly on the home trade. Then, when they wanted to force prices down, the raising of the embargo was promptly suggested, and on the mere rumors of a prospective importation of a comparatively few bushels of corn, the price of corn was forced down 17 cents a bushel. The same kind of rumors are good for another 40 or 50 cents per bushel decline. Okay, so back to the document. To me, that right there, I was thinking for a while that parity tariffs might be more important to concentrate on, but after I was looking at this, I'm thinking, no, you have to have some kind of farm price protection within the United States, just for the reason that he's going through here.
Yep.
Anyhow, okay, back to our document. The last segment in the first paragraph of parity prices reads, so we remember he says production of new wealth expanded constantly up until the 1940. So all the 140 years before then, 1800 forward, production of new wealth has expanded. But he's saying in this last sentence, production of new wealth has leveled off in America. Hence, there's no relief from permanent depression in sight except to bring prices of commodities and industrial goods into balance by the use of the commodity index pricing system. And then in the first paragraph, the second paragraph, he's saying how to do that. He says, to determine parity prices as of today, a commodity index reflecting the average weighted price of industrial goods is compared with either two base periods that they had at that time. They're called base periods, 1910 to 1914 and 1922 to 1929. And he says, when applied to agricultural products, it's possible to determine the price at which such products should sell in order to have the same purchasing power they had during those two base periods, 1910, 1914, 1922 to 29. And then there was a third added, 1947 to 1949. And to figure that parity price, I just wanted to run through an example. I think I got from Walters, but I forgot where. But he says, or I'm making this up, just pick out a year, 1980. And let's say that the commodity index stood at 240%. in 1980. Okay, so what you do is you add the base period. Doesn't matter which base period, they're all 100 cent. That's 100 cent dollar. Okay, so you add the base period of 100 to that 240%, you get 340, and just say corn is selling for 64 cents. You have to multiply that 340% to find the parity price for corn. That would mean in 1980, corn that was selling for 64 cents should be selling for about $2.10 a bushel. Wheat that was selling for 88 cents should be selling for $3 a bushel.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the way. It doesn't really matter the base period because they're all the 100 cent dollar idea.
Well, what matters, Jerry, what matters
okay.
with the base period is that that's where you take the price of the commodity from.
Say that again. I didn't hear that.
You take the index plus the base period and multiply that times the price of the commodity in the base period.
Okay, so it's not corn. So if we're talking about 1980.
Yep.
Okay.
But it doesn't matter.
So,
if you calculate it out to 340, then what you have to do is you have to take the price of the of corn in the parity period, the 1947 to 49 period, times 340%. And that would be the parity price of corn in 1980.
Oh, okay. Okay, so I got that wrong. Okay, so we have to revise that. It's in, so if you're using the parity period of 1910, because I had in Two Faces of Money, I had found, I think it was from Galbraith, he had worked backward, and I think Stephen asked this question before. You can work backward using those. What he had done was take the 1910 to 14 base period
yep.
and work backward to 1872.
Okay.
So you can do that, right?
Well, if you've got an industrial index.
That was the other question I was having. So the commodity, he says, a commodity index reflecting the average weighted price of industrial goods. Do we have those indexes now?
Well,
I was looking for them, and I thought, I don't know, this is pretty confusing. They have about 25 of them, or you
well,
know.
Well, that's everybody generates their own. They do.
So where does that leave us?
Stuck.
Uh-huh. Wonderful.
You know, we can calculate it out if we had the dollars to do the research, but my observation is simply that the parity ratio today is so minuscule that we might just as well let the USDA be hanged on their own hanging rope.
How can we do that?
So what? Because they calculate parity prices every month.
Oh.
And publish them. They're wrong.
I know. Oh, boy. So I think this is
but
one of the quandaries that we have now. I mean,
even with their own cheating numbers, the parity ratio most recently reported was 31. The farmer has paid 31 cents for every dollar's worth of wealth he delivers into the economy. Try and come up with a business plan that takes that into account. And that's USDA with cheating numbers and a bastardized formula. So that's, I don't care anymore. You know, let them be hung on their own petard. Anything would be better.
I'm just thinking how do you overcome that? There's so many layers and levels of.
You forget about it. It's not until anybody can come up with a cogent argument to challenge the use of USDA's numbers. Why bother? People don't understand parity to begin with. Shoot, even the guys in the USDA parity office that calculate the numbers don't know what the hell they're doing.
Right, that's for sure. Because my cousin sent me a little brochure. I don't know when it was written, like 1984 or something, a while ago. And it was pretty clear that maybe they were hell-bent on not understanding it. I don't know.
Well, Alan Perry, one of our NORM members from up in Maine, visited the Perry office in Washington, D.C., at one of the USDA buildings, walked in and introduced himself and thanked the people for continuing to calculate and publish the numbers. And every person in the office, I think there was like three or four people in the office, they all were just, their jaws hit the floor. We had no idea anybody found any value at all in any of this stuff. We thought we were just bureaucrats working bureaucracy. They don't know.
Wow. So,
Sue has a question.
Go
ahead.
Well, if we want to organize to add a parity section into the NEED Act, we need to be able to explain as simply how to get those parity prices.
Well, the first thing people will say is that why parity? That's price control. You know, that's the next section Jerry's going to go into. Parity price is not price fixing.
That's
the first complaint you get. And anything beyond that, I'll simply dismiss it with the following comment. Parity price is nothing more than the right price. It's the right price for the producer. It's the right price for the consumer. It's the right price for the community. It's the right price.
Was there somebody else there?
I just said, and the nation, and the national economy.
That's right. Yep. The community is small or as large as you want to define it. That's correct. It is the right price. That's what parity is. Because it expresses a relationship between the segments of everybody who's engaged in this thing. And it says we want our dollar to be 100 cents for everybody. And we want to have the widest distribution of purchasing power incomes so that we can put our demand into the markets and draw forth that production, consume it, provide for our necessities, find prosperity. It's the right price. And the point came up here the other day that somebody was saying, don't you need permission to do that? And I said, think about that one. What, we need permission to do the right thing?
Oh, when you were talking at the conference in New York, and somebody asked you the question about, what was it? Something about, it had to do with Wall Street and price discovery.
Oh.
Well, I'm calling it price discovery.
Mm-hmm.
And you had said, I remember you saying that in that one video that you gave a talk to that University of Utah or something, and you said, we don't need price discovery when we can figure out these things mathematically.
Right.
And whatever you said in that, I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but what you said in the conference, I thought, wow, you can hear a pin drop in that conference. Nobody said anything.
Exactly.
What? This is totally new. This is totally foreign to us.
Sue has a question. So this says to me, this discussion we're having right now, that really what needs to be explained to people is how an economy works.
Yeah, that's what I think. Well, that's part of what we're doing, aren't we, Stephen? We're trying to develop a curriculum of sorts for ourselves and other people.
Yeah, I'm defining your talk as the rise of parity thinking and pricing, you know, late 19th, early 20th century. And, I haven't said a lot, and maybe a few others have it, but we're taking in the gestalt, and I think Sue's statement is explaining an economy, and with Randy's parity price is the right price. You know, it shows a relationship, a proper relationship that's good for buyer, seller, community, smaller or larger. Those are key concepts that we need to get across. And, we'll just keep listening and learning, and we've got to be able to bring up something coherent over time.
Right.
I'm just being
patient
right now.
When you talk about this, it's like there's so many walls that have been built, like with the free trade thing. It's hard to know when you're going to run it. Well, it's kind of like with modern monetary theory. But, right, something cohesive. And shall I continue with parity price, the next part?
Yeah.
Unless does somebody else have anything to add?
You're on a streak, Jerry. You might as well go.
Okay. Parity price, not price fixing. That's the second segment. And Wilkins said, many people jump to the conclusion that parity means price fixing. Yeah, even more so now than probably back then. I don't know. But anyhow, he says it's not true. Parity means price balancing. And then he goes on to talk about the index, commodity index, that's established by competitive selling price of finished goods. It will go up and down as cost factors enter into the whole scenario. And by the same token, that means that prices of farm products and living costs also go up and down with the index. And he says, in normal times, prices would be practically constant. And then he talks about the parity period from 1922 to 29. He says, basically effects on the living costs to increase the parity price for farmers would be basically negligible because the other elements go up, the cost of the income and all of that is going to go up. So, take those things into consideration. You have a negligible impact, basically, on living costs, which is the one thing, that the populace were given and that the parity people were given. Well, the increase in farm prices means that, all the other prices are going up. We have to have cheap food because we have to give, food stamps out, whatever reason they have. They get all these goofy reasons that have nothing to do with anything. Anyhow, the last segment, why the nation is in the red. We got another big graph. and he says, the graph reveals how nearly normal or at point of 100 the commodity index is compared to the dollar ran from 1922 to 1929. So the top big thick line is a purchasing power of the U.S. dollar from 1921 to 1938, about thereabouts. So the bar up on the left side goes from 60 to 100 to 150 to 200, and it measures the purchasing power of the dollar with that black line. And then across you have the years from 21 on. Then you have the national income for each of those years, factory payroll for each of those years. And then the bars at the bottom, the dark part is income, so you can see it visually. Income from farm products is the darkened area, and then income from other raw materials are the lighter area. Okay, so one of the interesting things here to me was 1921, you've got purchasing down power of the dollar down at 60. And what happened in 1920, the Federal Reserve Board and a handful of Congress people decided that the way farmers were earning too much in the during the war years. So they had to bring about, I don't know if they exactly said this, but they had to bring about, bring the prices down.
Well, what was happening was the inflation during World War One.
Right.
What happened in 1920, it's what happened just before then.
Exactly. And Herbert Hoover, because I wrote about this about my grandfather, because he went through this. Herbert Hoover was saying, oh, you know, everybody go into debt and, to the farmers. We got to feed the people in Europe, and, you know, they don't have farms anymore, and we got to feed them. So go into debt, do whatever it takes, and then we'll boost the price for, I think they had a price for wheat and maybe one other commodity. I don't remember. But anyway, after the war, then all of a sudden, they're saying, oh, well, you know, we have to bring down inflation. And so they didn't tell anybody, but the board and these few Congress people said, well, we're going to increase the rediscount rates from 2% in May of 1920 to 8 months later, it was over 9%, and it was way higher in some of the agricultural regions. So that cut farm prices, farm income, in half or more. The banks failed all over the place. There was, I think, 600. This was the start of the farm depression, the first farm depression in 1920. There was 5 million people thrown out of work in 1921. So that's where you get that dip. And then you get the roaring 20s through there, but there's a farm depression going on because these rural banks are failing all over the place. So it's giving you a double picture, but the idea here is that there is a 100-cent dollar that gives you visually here that agriculture, what I'm saying is that it's not like farmers are going to be rolling in dough anytime soon because of parity prices. But to stop the movement of this, you know, up and down cycle of wealth taking and wealth gathering, whatever, you have to do this kind of measure to stabilize the national income by stabilizing first farm income, gross farm income, because farming is the leader. It has the biggest multiplier of any other income group. What I wanted to ask, I think there was a couple things I was wondering about. So Wilkin is talking about these three banks as clearing banks, St. Paul, Minneapolis, and Sioux City.
Right.
Okay, and my grandfather had a little bank. This is a very convoluted idea. It's contrary to what he was because he was a populist. But this little bank in this tiny little town of Dante fell into his lap because farm country was in trouble, and his friend James Wagner had to go manage the other bank. Anyway, he went into debt. They all were in debt. Sioux City was one of the clearing banks. It was the clearing bank for where my grandfather was.
Okay.
And then Minneapolis was one of the Federal Reserve bank centers, one of the 12, wasn't it? Okay, so you had these three big banks, and what Wilkin says here is that he says it's amazing that so he shows how many losses compared to the parity period 1922 to 29 and the Depression era 32 to 39. He's showing the losses of these banks. Then he says, it's amazing that an area such as the Twin Cities, St. Paul, and Minneapolis would take a loss of $12.5 billion in 8 years without someone doing something about it. God. Increase the bank clearings of those communities an additional $1.5 billion a year by means of parity prices, and their unemployed will go off the relief rolls in no time. The same thing applies to every other community in the 40 states that depend primarily on money received from production and sale of raw materials or the products of new wealth. And then he goes, later he says, arithmetic is an exact science and no amount of theory can disprove the record of what has transpired in the clearinghouses of the three cities cited as examples. Pages could be filled with comparable records of what has transpired in every city in the land. So did he compile any other records? Do you know, Randy?
Well,
did they have his team?
They compiled numbers forever. I mean, one of the Vincent Rossiter was one of the Shining Lights of Norm in the 80s.
And he was a banker.
He was a banker from Hardington, Nebraska. He was always fiddling with Federal Reserve reports and data collections and things. The thing about these bank clearings, those columns of the three cities, what he's trying to show you there is take the average number down at the bottom and look at the column of numbers above it and see how consistent they are.
Right.
And then in the columns from 32 to 39, look at the average and the columns above it and see how variable they are. They bounce all over the place. That's what he's trying to show you.
Okay, so in the previous thing, priority price, not price fixing, he says, he's talking about the recovery period on the upgrade to 1937. Farm prices rose 86% from the low levels of 1932.
Right.
Was that because Roosevelt had put in, I guess, the equivalent of a minimum wage for farms in 35 or 36? I thought I read that.
Well, no. Well,
no.
That
okay.
may have been done, but that's not what was going on. What was going on was that the make-work programs were actually having a positive impact on the ability of people to cash flow.
So like the Civilian Conservation Corps and the WPA?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. The problem with those programs was that although most of the people in those programs would send half of their money home.
Yeah, to farms. I know. My uncle was in that.
But the deal was that the person who's in the WPA sending half of his money home was not on the farm to do the work.
Right.
So how's that going to work out?
Yeah. My grandmother did it. That's what
exactly.
worked out.
Exactly. Yep.
with a horse and plow. That's how she did it.
Farmer works from sun to sun, but a woman's work is never done. That's correct. Yep.
They all work, but she got him. She talked him into going there. I think she wanted to get him away from the stepfather, but also to try to get some extra income in
exactly.
To the farm, because that was also a period of the Dust Bowl era.
Yeah, that's right.
Out there in South Dakota.
But those are the sorts of life-changing decisions that we forced people to make.
Right.
Which is ungodly. It's just unconscionable.
It is. It is, totally. And we've got a similar kind of thing going on now. I mean, it's a replay in a lot of ways.
Yes, it is.
From, and maybe worse. So it's, I mean.
They've expanded the helplines for the suicide help.
For the farmers?
Yep.
And do you ever hear of this? I mean, I did hear on a mainstream news channel, CBS or one of those, you know, they did say that it lasted about 3 seconds, that half of all dairy farmers in Wisconsin in the last 5 years went out of business.
That's correct.
So as long as it took me to say that, that's how long it lasted, and that's the end. You never heard of it again.
That's correct.
You did hear more about it during the 1980s than you do now. Now it's like most people are under the impression that these farmers are rolling in dough. They just they have so much money they don't know what to do with it.
Well, there's a whole lot more coming as far as the risk of suicides and stuff, because the number of non-performing loans in the farm credit system right now is about, it's as high as it's been since the 1980s.
Wow. And then you've got student loan debt, and no wonder they want to monetize carbon and other kinds of crap. Sort of scary.
Yep.
There was something else that I had a question about, too, and I can't think of it right now.
I have a quick question if you're thinking about one.
Sure.
I was wondering, Randy or Jerry or anybody, is anybody hearing anything from Ben Giesen? He was a Wyoming banker who felt bad about what was happening, and he went over to writing and thinking about organic farming. But I bring up his name because he was really a wonderful Fed Federal Reserve watcher, a Fed watcher.
Right. Yes, he was.
And I had some contact with him, but I sort of lost, and I don't know if he's still with us or...
I don't know either, Stephen, but it's he used to publish a magazine called Touch the Soil.
I have some copies.
Right. That was, I think, out of either Washington or Oregon was where he was publishing that. I haven't heard from him, and I don't know if he's still going or not.
Okay. But he was just a really good. He could go over the Fed numbers that would be published, and he could really discuss them from what's going on for rural bankers or for bankers in general.
Mm-hmm.
But also he had a feeling for the farmers, too. So
he did. In fact, he one of the articles in one of his magazines, I've got a copy of it here, he talked about Norm as having developed what he called a cash flow analysis of the United States economy.
Okay, wow.
That's what he called it. That's what his analysis of what we do was that.
You know what? That's a good descriptive term to use, too.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, so we should keep that in mind.
Of course, it depends. A cash flow analysis depends upon having cash to flow.
Oh, that's...
Details! that reminds me, I think that's going to bring me to my question. Hopefully I'm not going to forget it. There's this guy I was watching, Peter Yang. I think his name is Yang. The Yang Gang, he's running for president. And he's a tech guy, he's own his own business. And he's talking about the citizen's dividend. Oh, no, he calls it freedom dividend. But he brought up this... I thought he was bringing up Kuznets' equations, because Kuznets at one time wanted to count housewives' contribution to the national income, and he parted ways with whoever he worked for, Department of Commerce or something, because they wouldn't include that in his income equation.
Okay.
Do you know about that, Randy?
No, I don't.
Okay. Well, I'm sure that it was Kuznets he was talking about, but what I wanted to ask was, the Kuznets, we talked about Kuznets' equation, I think, on the last call, maybe. So Kuznets figured out, he was talking about production, not counting in, I think it was services, in with his figures.
Finance?
Oh, okay. Did you say Wilkin had a different view on that, from Kuznets, how they figured the income equation? I'm trying to find my notes for where that...
Well, no, Kuznets really didn't come up with an equation. What he came up with is an analytical sorting box. And what he observed, the observation he started with, was that the necessities of life are the important productive items of an economy. If you're not producing food, clothing, shelter, water, sewage, transportation, et cetera, then you're not doing right by your community. And so let us look at the production of those items and what it takes to get them produced, distributed, and consumed. And how do we count these things? How do we analyze the productive efforts, the products produced, how they are processed, how they are transported, how they are delivered to the consumer, and what happens to them after they've been partially or wholly consumed? You know, let us analyze the economy on those terms. And that's why he excluded finance, because it's not a productive... it doesn't produce food, clothing, or shelter, or transportation. It doesn't lay a rail. You can't get your dollar to saw the tree down.
Okay. I found later that he also wanted to include the work of housewives, taking care of kids and whatever, in his category.
Oh, yeah.
I found this.
Which person is this, Jerry?
Kuznets, Simon Kuznets.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah, but I thought you spoke about another person who wanted to...
Oh, that's Andrew Yang or something. He's really interesting. I don't like his dividend thing, but you got to listen to him because I think we might be able to talk to him. But anyhow,
spell his last name.
Yang. He's Asian. I don't know what kind of Asian, but
oh, yeah.
The Yang Gang, he calls his groupies.
California.
Okay.
Is he from California?
I think so.
He's really sharp. He's pretty sharp. And I don't know. He looks like out of the current crop. Him and Tulsi Gabbard look like the best.
I think Buttigieg is a fellow to look at, too. Frank.
You do? Oh, I don't like him. Maybe that's what I heard on his speech. I didn't like him at all.
What's the matter with him?
Anyhow, and I also was really suspicious because he raised $1 million the first day of announcing. And he had this huge crowd that people drove in from, I mean, he lives in Indianapolis, for God's sake. And they drove in from all over the place. I mean, how in the hell did they hear about him? Give me a break. Mm-hmm. I don't trust him at all.
Who
I mean, I'm a Kucinich fan.
Who lives in Indianapolis?
Buttigieg.
He's the mayor of South Bend, Indiana. How can he live in Indianapolis?
South Bend, I'm sorry. South Bend. I get him confused.
Oh, okay. All right. Just check.
But here's I found the notes. This is what was in the notes. Randy answers that service industries are not considered in Kuznets, not Wilkins' definition of national income. Kuznet looked at income generated in the production of things, not income generated for increase of the standard of living. He said, in effect, we have to earn enough to support additional services that might add to the standard of living. And this is where concepts of GNP and GDP come from. They, that is the powers of be, try to account for another level of economic activity, failing in the process to understand that if we don't earn enough on the production of new wealth level, then we can't have enough to pay for services. So... So Wilkin included service industries in his calculations, or?
Well, there are certain services that are required to run a business. I mean, every farmer I know keeps records of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every iron
so does
foundry
he have...
has to keep track of their costs and expenses. I mean, the accountants are of important, essential part of the business.
So did I write that wrong or right, that service industries are not considered in Kuznets? Or
no, that's not true, no.
That they are considered?
They are, yeah, many of them
so
are.
So I was probably hearing you wrong because you meant the fire sector, basically.
Yeah, well, mostly. It's finance. I don't care about real
finance.
Estate. Real estate is kind of a...
Okay,
that's,
yeah.
That's the place.
Finance and insurance.
Stuffed, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, finance and insurance, yep. Yeah, those are all money games, and they're played by people with large piles of cash.
And I'm not sure if we tried to use, I'm thinking here, Stephen, in your curriculum, if we tried to bring in Kuznets all that much, because Kuznets has basically been marginalized anyway. I mean, to use him as a one support mechanism, you know?
Well, it's the only important thing there is that's where it started, where this analysis started. And it was, I mean, he won a Nobel Prize for his contributions.
Right.
Kuznets did.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was a good beginning. I mean, that's a sound way to do it. What's happened since then is that people have taken it and, as most human organizations do, run right into the weeds with it and think that they've discovered gold.
That's a good word. Yeah, it is smart.
Yeah,
good.
Look how smart
you can get it.
Smart,
okay.
Not wise.
So on our Why the Nation is in the Red, so parity prices and the 100-cent dollar that we're in trouble now. Obviously, we only got parity prices for a few years, 1942 to 52 or thereabouts.
Yep, an 11-year period.
So for the rest of that time, we've been expanding our income with debt. I mean, we always did all the way along, because that's what was happening in the populist period too.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
This guy by the name of James Neal Prim wrote Our Foregone Conclusion. It was an apology for the Federal Reserve System. And that book is posted at the St. Louis Fed. But anyway, he says that there was more deposits in the banks in 1896 or 1893 than all of the outstanding money that was available. And that and that gold was starting to come into circulation, so the populace didn't have to worry that the money supply was going to increase. Anyway, but Luke's gives some really good examples of how gold was being pulled out of circulation in 1913-14 when the Fed was being formed.
Right. Well, that was another thing that was happening in 1920 and 21, was that the British, after the World War, the Great War, we're trying to maintain the pound sterling on a gold basis, $4.53 or whatever it was. And they found they had so much debt they couldn't do it any longer. They had to devalue the pound.
So I'm thinking about, again, the control of the money supply, and then they know that through this they can control farm prices. So it was Hudson, right? That I don't know, Joe or maybe Stephen Hudson determines monetary value, or he did. I know he did. For Babylonia, but by through the commodity price relationships. I'm trying to figure out why Hudson wants to define money as debt.
Oh. No, I can't do that, and I'm at a loss of how Hudson can do it, and I think that's the problem Jamie has.
Oh, I can do it.
Wondering why Hudson is where he's at.
Well, I can define money as debt, but it's a bit beyond. It actually has absolutely nothing at all to do with the topics we're discussing. Money is a debt because it is issued by the community in lieu of wealth. Money is a claim on wealth. So instead of delivering the wealth that you might need to you, we're not going to give it to you. We're going to give you money. Go and fetch it yourself.
So that's how Hudson, see, I wouldn't see it. I look at it as the money
know.
Is.
Well, I don't know if that's what Hudson says.
Right. Well, it has to be. I think that sounds like words that Jamie and, well, Michael, Hudson, when I listened to him in that, at the AMI, one of the, where he does a song and dance about money's debt, and he start yelling at Stephen.
Right.
And it was Steve Walsh and Joe Bongiovanni that were.
Well, all I'm saying, it really doesn't make any difference. It's still, to define money that way, it makes no difference to parity or parity tariffs or how the economy works or anything else. It's just that's how things work. So it's not debt that has to be paid back. It's not debt that accrues interest. It's just a debt of the community owed in wealth to the individual.
Yeah, that's why I call it a public credit, not debt. It's not debt, and the credit's defined in Webster's Dictionary. It should be pretty easy.
But the community owes it, And that essence means that because that's the stamp of the community, the legal stamp says.
Right. That's a social and economic compact between the government and the public.
Well, the government.
It's not like a bank, which is how.
That's correct.
You know
what?
That's
right. It is not like a bank. That's right. Absolutely correct.
And I think Hudson created a bit of a scene at that thing, and he should have been yelling at Stephen and Joe, but he was yelling at Sarlinga instead for whatever reason he had. But the thought process that keeps him locked in that frame of mind is, you know, because I don't think he was like that before, right, Stephen? Hudson?
He was wishy-washy, and he never was committal.
Right.
When I first heard about MMT 9 or 10 years ago, whenever it was, Warren Chamberlain used to be part of AMI discussion boards, and he brought it up. And I looked at it and thought, this is a bunch of poppycock. Who wants to listen to it? But I went and looked, you know, and I'd see Hudson on different blogs or whatever, and he would say, I saw him a couple times say, well, let's be honest or let's be truthful, whatever. We have to state the facts that the government should issue money. And then he'd go into the MMT thing.
Oh.
So, you know, but he said it. If we could recapture those blogs, we can say, well, look, here, this is what you said. Did you change your mind? And if you did, explain how.
Well, but if it helps us understand it ourselves,
right,
we can explain it to somebody else, that's good. If it's just
more
mental gymnastics
true.
To try and to understand somebody's crap, then why bother?
Well, to me, MMT is mental gymnastics.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is.
I think so, too. It's
so,
a postmodern interpretation of sophist smoke.
I think I remembered what I had. Now, these bank clearings, what are they representing? So, say my grandfather, we have checks. He was sued. His estate was sued by Sioux City and by this other bank, Tabor. And so we have all the checks. I have copies of the checks. They're not checks. They're loans to the farmers. And what was happening is those banks, both Tabor, Sioux City went, it suspended notes in 1929, I think. But Tabor went under, I think, 1926. It didn't go under. It had to reorganize. And Dante went under in 25. But what do they mean by the clearing? So say my grandfather's bank and my uncle's bank, they are, my uncle is a cashier. He's making loans to the farmers, and then some of them he has to sell to Tabor because they're already getting in trouble. And then Tabor has to make friends with Sioux City.
No, that's not what this is. Bank clearings, do you know what a clearinghouse does?
No.
Okay. Clearinghouse... my nephew used to work from 8 p.m. till 4 a.m. in the bank in Coldwater, Michigan, in the basement, running the computer, doing the clearings.
Okay.
All the activity during the day, all the patrons who have deposits in the bank that may have gone to the neighboring town or even as far as Indianapolis or Chicago and written a check, then the banks over there have to send that check drawn on the Coldwater Bank to the clearinghouse where the accounts are balanced. And the account that you have in the Coldwater Bank is debited, and the account of the person to whom the check was written gets the credit for the money. And your account in your bank is diminished and their account is increased. And then you get the check back because the clearinghouse has settled the accounts, and it happens every day.
Well, now it happens.
And that's the same thing for the Federal Reserve with the banks.
It happens at all levels of banking. The clearinghouse,
right.
That's really what the Federal Reserve provides, is clearinghouse accounting across the nation. And they do it at various levels. I think Joe's got as firm a grip on all that process as anybody I've ever talked with.
Yeah.
Randy, I hear what you're saying there, and I agree about all of that, the clearing that takes place, but would that be the same answer to Jerry's question with regard to the bank, the process of, that was going on with the banks failing and running into a clearing problem? Is that the same thing? That's what I'm wondering about.
Me too.
Yeah.
Here's the thing, because the other thing that Luke's brings in during the formation of the Federal Reserve is that they were trying to figure out a way to get these rural banks out, and they were increasing the paid-in capital amounts and a few other things.
Well, they required to be paid in gold.
The capital, I'm not sure of the capital. They required farmers' debts to be paid in gold.
Well,
did they require the capital, paid-in capital in gold, too?
If you tried to become a member of the Federal Reserve System, you had to provide...
Oh, no, I don't think this little bank was part of the Federal Reserve System.
Right.
But Sioux City at that point was, right? That's what these clearinghouses are.
Probably. Well, they are now, I guess in the 20s. Well, they probably didn't have it. The Federal
Sioux
Reserve
City was the national bank.
But the Federal Reserve only began operations in November of 1914. And they
right.
certainly did
yeah.
not have the clearinghouses all established and functioning perfectly for several years, would be my guess.
Right, right. So, but it must have been by 1922 if he's got these figures, right?
Well, yeah, that's what those numbers are. Those are the clearings that happened during
mm-hmm.
those years, yep.
Yeah, and these are the years I'm talking about, 1921, 22, and 23.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So...
Yeah, well, if a bank gets unstable or can't cover its loan portfolio with the reserves or the deposits on hand or whatever, you know, or their own investments, then, yeah, the bank examiners come along and squeeze them dry.
Yeah, well, there's another story behind that, too. But,
oh, absolutely. There always is. It's... that's the way it works. I mean,
you know what the historian at Pier told us, the archives at Pier? He said that, because I was looking for the bank commissioner records, and he said that I wanted more. And he said, well, they destroyed a lot of the bank records. They didn't destroy them. They decided... I don't know, 1925 or some time like that, to use the old bank records to build a dam in Pier at the river, in the Missouri River, in Pier.
Idea.
So they poured them into the river.
Right.
But, okay, so the checks, I know some of these checks were being turned over.
It's not just checks. It's also... the one thing that was new when the Federal Reserve took operation was what were called bankers' acceptances. There's also commercial paper. The clearings also include commercial paper, which are just an accounting form that settles accounts of large commercial customers. If you don't know what commercial paper is, we can look at that. But the other item that the Federal Reserve, that was never used in this country until the Federal Reserve began operating, and that's called bankers' acceptances. Commercial paper is one signature paper, and bankers' acceptances are two signature paper, commercial paper. They're like checks, you know. It's
mm-hmm.
It was checks before people had checking accounts. That's how business got done. You had a pile of money in your account at the commercial bank, and you went down to the stock exchange or the Comex or wherever it was, and you wanted to buy You wanted to buy a house full of lumber so you can make furniture or whatever, and you've got it ordered up, and here it comes on the truck. And when you go in to bid, well, as before it gets delivered, you go in to bid on a pack of lumber, and when you make the exchange with the timber man, why, then you just write a piece of paper down and bonk, and you hand it to him, and that's his commercial paper. He takes it to the bank, and his own bank, and then it's up to the clearinghouse to settle the accounts.
Hmm.
That's business. That's commercial business. That's how it works. That's,
mm-hmm.
you know, all those little pieces of paper on the floor of the stock exchange that they used to have to sweep up, and somebody had to look through them and add them all up and find out who they were to and who they were for and what was the price. That's commercial paper. It litters the floor, and they're in such a hurry, they just drop it on the floor and let the guys who sweep up feed it to the clearinghouse. They don't do that anymore. That was the advantage of computerization now, but...
Yeah. Well, anybody else got anything to add or questions? Or?
I think I should go over it and read a little bit more and just absorb it that way a little bit. I've taken about four pages of notes to go
wow.
along with things. That is
well, I'll listen to the recording
cost,
and see
yeah.
if I can add in some, maybe a separate sheet of notes, or I don't know, but I'll send it so that you can have it for that too. Have something in writing.
Okay, that'd be great.
Hey, Jerry.
Yeah.
I just want to say thanks again, because this to me is a really important, almost critical piece of our ignorance, if you will, about how things have evolved to become the way they are. And it's so
right.
great somebody like yourself has a handle on this history, not only your personal involvement, but who these thought leaders are, because I'm just of the opinion that that this represents a most obvious component of what would be the lost science of money, because
right
the fact that even in my own study, my own personal study of the monetary system, I didn't come across any of the writing, well, very few, a little of the writings of the people that you mentioned, and to have them have been reported to us in this way, to me, is a remarkable achievement on your part, and again, contributing to my personal education in a most significant way. So thanks very much for taking this on as a task and a job well done. Doing it.
Well, thanks, Jill. Because it took, I'm trying to think, because Sue was going, do all that. And I thought, no, I think our team is up to it. But the thing of it is, one of the things that we've been going over, for a long time, how do we define money? We've been doing that for years. But we talked about in our previous calls, some of these terms. And a lot of the terms have concepts behind them. And also, how does an economy work? So to me, it sort of helped us get a better handle on how the economy works and why something like parity price and a parity tariff, to me, it lays the groundwork for what we're going to be doing in, with the rest of the booklet.
Great. Again, thanks. Looking forward
I say thank you to Jerry and to Randy and to everybody just to be listening and participating. So thank you, too.
Right, yeah. Yeah, lucky Randy was here. We didn't hear much from Wendell. He was kind of quiet. But anyhow, maybe Wendell is going to be more vociferous when we go into parity tariffs.
Well, I think Wendell's got a good handle on how this stuff gets perceived or dismissed more than anything
yeah,
else.
Yeah, so, right, and so he would probably be really helpful for us, you know, when we try to write our curriculum or communicate it with the powers that be, whoever they might end up being, you know, if Jamie managed to find a way to get another NEDACT in, you know, whatever, but we have to find a way to keep it as clear as possible, as short as possible, but emphasize, you know, so that you don't lose sight of the importance of it.
Right.
And we're not going to let them forget it. That's it. We're not going to let these guys forget it. They keep loving to forget this shit. No,
yeah.
No more.
Believe me, we as NORM members talk about this all the time, and I love listening to this stuff, and I'm going to hear it again and again and again, because for some reason it takes a certain part of your brain to understand this that's not normally
mm-hmm.
used out here in the real world. And not only is it as a discipline I'm trying to learn, because I know it's very, very important, and once you you don't have to understand it. You have to know it's there. You're down a rabbit hole, like other people say in other disciplines, and you don't come
yeah.
back from it. And you need to learn it, and you need to understand it. And I want to, and repetition is the only way I know, because I get no other form than NORM, or now I'm listening to you, ladies and gentlemen, to hone my knowledge, because, number one, you don't hear it out in the real world, and number two, nobody seems to be relating to it. We talk about
right.
that on NORM all the time.
Yeah, and that's one of the things, that's one of our projects. Steve is kind of spearheading, Stephen, with
Thank
his
you.
Curriculum, and he has a gift for condensing this stuff and making it relatable to today's audiences. But we're all in this together. I mean, he can't do it alone, so that's what we're trying to do someday before we're dead.
Well,
leave it for posterity if it takes us that long, but we're going to do it.
Good.
Yeah.
Well, thanks everybody for being in there and being on the team. It's really great. Really
yeah. Thanks. I haven't heard from. Has anybody heard from Mary? I haven't heard from her in like weeks and weeks.
Well, let's see. Mary was on our Sue. You still on?
Yes.
Mary participated in one of our banking and monetary reform committee meetings of the Green Party within the last week or so. I know she was in, there. That's as much as I know.
Oh. Okay. Well, I thought she was going to be on, but we didn't get any report back from her. And then the only other person that we're missing is Ann.
Ann said she was going to be on. She didn't come on?
Didn't hear her.
Not that I heard. I don't think
okay.
so.
I'll have to talk to her tomorrow, see what
yeah.
happened.
Well, this is recorded, so she can listen. And then I'm going to try to get some notes together after I listen to the recording. It might take me a while, though. And then send out my notes. So Stephen especially will have something concrete to go back to. It'll go to everybody, though.
Well, I'll shut the recording off and keep it manual.
Yeah. Okay, so I think we got done with parity prices and we got parity tariffs for the next call. Do we want to set a time, a day or time?